Everybody's running when the circus comes into their towns. Everyone is running from the likes of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
.com. Did you say Junk Food Cinema?
Yes.
Holy shit.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to talk about this movie that, oh my God. If there is a quintessential 80s movie that sums up everything that is this podcast, it might just be Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
That is a good summation. It includes junk food. It includes murder. It includes satire and comedy. It includes great comedic, actors.
And John Vernon.
And John Vernon.
So, I mean, pretty much all the bases covered. What are we talking about? Just so you know, if you haven't already figured it out, this is, in fact, Junk Food Cinema, the weekly cult and exploitation filmcast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, screenwriter, lieutenant of Megaforce, the other half of this insane clown posse, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
So, by the way, Faygo will not be the junk food pairing this week. Just want to nip that one in the bud.
All right, and I am actually officially a killer clown from outer space.
Yes, that's what's great about this movie, is we already have so much to talk about within the movie itself, and now we have a great story to go along with that, and we are going to get to that right after I do all of...
The business.
The business! Here comes the business. You can find us, by the way, our entire back catalog on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean, really like the show.
If you like it more than clowns like popcorn and juggling and destroying all humans, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as $1 an episode, you will get access to content that nobody else gets to hear. Things like our mailbag episodes, our a la modes, lots of random shit that we do. Like, there's a lot of content there. I'm actually pretty pleased with everything we've managed to do there. And I think the patrons have been super supportive and really appreciative of everything that goes in there. So get on board that train. Now, continuing Summer of 88, as we mentioned, oh boy, we're going to Clown Town with Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
It was a night like any other night. Then, something happened.
You see that?
Something different.
It's no shooting star.
Why here? Why now? Why clowns? They've been knocking them dead all over the universe.
What are you gonna do? Knock my block off?
Soon they'll be doing it at a theater near you.
Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Maybe they're just cruising through the galaxy and stopped here for a bite to eat.
Uh-oh. They want to play games? They're messing with the wrong guy.
What are you in for?
Killer Clowns from Outer Space. It's crazy.
So wait, did we just play the trailer?
We just played the trailer.
Okay, see, no, that's not what you're supposed to do.
No?
You have to play the song.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's possibly one of my favorite theme songs of the entire 80s. To get a band, a punk band like the Dickies, to come in and record the theme song for a movie called Killer Clowns from Outer Space that is in fact about killer clowns from outer space, that is fucking rad.
And it's very apropos of of 88 when it came out and of what we're covering. Because what you have to keep in mind is this movie is, as you can tell from the title, not a serious film.
No.
But what it really is it's not just a jokey film. It's not a gory schlock-tastic movie. It's a real parody. It's a satire. It has stuff to say while it's also making fun of the movies these guys grew up with, particularly, as they say themselves, the first half of this movie is The Blob.
Beware of the clowns.
In 1958 Blob. So it was really interesting that in the summer of 88, you had two movies remaking The Blob. One literally and one on the sly, but with clowns.
It might explain why watching these two movies back-to-back works so well. In fact, I joked about this on Twitter that we all know about John Carpenter's Apocalypse Trilogy, but I think there's another Apocalypse Trilogy and watching The Blob, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and Night of the Creeps, and assuming that all of those crafts landed on Earth on the same day.
Yeah, and they're all 50s riffs.
Yeah, they are absolutely 50s riffs.
Those three movies together, you would start with The Blob 88, you'd follow up with Night of the Creeps, and then you'd kill it with the midnight movie of Killer Clowns.
Kill it with the clowns, baby. Kill it with the clowns.
And that is an amazing night of 80s nostalgia for the 50s, killing lots of people in lots of interesting and very different ways.
This is very true. All of those movies have no reservations whatsoever about high body counts. They're movies that are ready to wipe out an entire town.
Yeah, absolutely. And they have fun doing it.
So much fun doing it. So much fun, of course, because at the helm of this movie is not one, not two, but three Kyoto brothers.
Yeah, the Kyoto brothers, who also have a very important tie into the 80s, as they were puppeteers. And they were the puppeteers that did The Critters, among other movies.
Which is crazy, because I feel like the one movie missing from her Apocalypse trilogy is maybe The Critters. So, and they're involved with that one, too.
Because Critters 2 doesn't really hold up.
Wait, were they involved with Critters 2 or with
Critters?
I don't
know if they were involved in Critters 2 or not, but because I feel like the puppet...
No, I meant Critters also. Like, yes. Critters should also be a part of that package deal.
Yeah, yeah. I would concur, but the thing with Critters is Critters doesn't quite go as deep into the 50s nostalgia
as those other three films do, which is why
I think they all go together so well.
Well, and that's a trait that we've talked about with the 80s so many times, is that the 80s fetishizes the 50s the way currently we fetishize the 80s.
Yeah, and that's going to go away, and people are getting sick of nostalgia, and it's starting to finally wane, and we'll finally, you know, put the 80s away in a little box. We're getting the last few bits of that out. There's a great movie that's on the festival circuit right now called Summer of 84. That is really fucking good. We will talk about eventually once it comes out. I think it comes out on VOD and in certain theaters in August. So you can expect an a la mode on that, because that's one of my favorite movies of the year already. And I know Brian's going to lose his shit for it.
Hilariously, just to take a quick sidebar,
Wait, are we taking a trip to the sidebar?
Oh, yeah. Ah! Thank you, Jason Murphy. So my brother actually, because you've been talking about that movie for a while, my brother texted me two nights ago with the poster for Summer of 84, just a picture of it, and underneath it says, "What the fuck is this? This looks awesome." And I was like, yeah, no, it's been getting, you know, a lot of great buzz on the festival circuit, and it's been described to me, which was by you, as Stranger Things meets Rear Window. And yeah. I was like, oh my God, that's absolutely something I need to see. And that poster with just the milk carton is so, like, it's the reason that when you used to go into video stores in the horror section that you would just rent anything, because they used to take so much care into making those horror posters so iconic and eye-catching. And this one for Killer Clowns from Outer Space has got a great poster too, of just a single clown hand spinning the world on its finger like it's MJ spinning a basketball. I always remember that cover. But yes, much like The Blob and much like Night of the Creeps, this movie is so excited to do its version of 80s sci-fi, 80s invasion sci-fi, so much so that actually the sheriff of this town, played by John Vernon, in his most I'm fed up with this shit performance, he's playing a character named Curtis Mooney, which I believe is also the name of the sheriff in the original Blob. Like, they're not being shy about it.
No, they were clearly ripping off the Blob and having fun with the Blob and going, what's sillier than the Blob? And what's scarier? Like, that was the thing, is they were trying to think up something scary, and one night one of the Kyoto brothers was driving and gets passed on the road by a guy in a clown suit and was really creeped out by it and thought, is there anything creepier than a clown where it shouldn't be? And he told that to his brothers, and they thought, yeah, that's pretty creepy. And then they started kicking around this idea for this movie. And this movie is very much playing with the Blob and then going to very different places.
Yes. Now, this takes place just outside the town of Crescent Cove, where our hero, Mike Tobacco.
Yes.
Mike Tobacco is the character's actual fucking name. I love it. And his girlfriend, Debbie, are parked at Lover's Lane. Again, so 50s, so and reminiscent of something that happens at the beginning of Night of the Creeps. And when they see a comet fly overhead and it crash lands, and wouldn't you know it, it's not a spaceship, but a circus tent that lands in the middle of the woods. And so they venture inside and go exploring and find that there are clowns inside, big-ass, creepy-looking motherfucking clowns. And I say that knowing full well that clowns in their natural habitat are creepy as it is in our world right now. But the puppets that the Kyoto brothers make for this movie are outstandingly unsettling.
Yes, very much
so. So good. They are such... Like, when I think of the great practical effects of the 80s, this is actually one of the things I think about, is just the diversity and the amount of range of emotion and movement in these clowns that they designed. And there's so many different variations of them.
Well, the thing I think that is best about this movie, like, the humor is great and the parody is fun. But what I really adore about this movie is it's a very hands-on, low-budget movie that deals with things using previous technology. And so they've got a bunch of stuff that's puppets that at the time were somewhat state of the art. It's a lot of rubber suits. And then there's matte paintings.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many cool matte paintings in this movie. And it's very, you know, like, you didn't see a lot of those after Star Wars. Like, that was just a thing that kind of went away with the advent of blue screen. And they didn't have money for blue screen because blue screen was expensive at the time. And so they ended up doing all these matte paintings and doing everything they could practically, which is what makes this movie work. Half of the enjoyment of watching Killer Clowns from Outer Space is watching the craft of this world, this thing that feels very tactile. It feels very real. And it's all very fun.
Well, and I think there's a certain element of building a ship in a bottle here, because you really do lock yourself into this concept of, okay, they're clowns from outer space, but everything they do, every method of dispatching people, every functional aspect of their spaceship and how they exist is built around clowns, clown gimmicks, clown, and they really do find a way to throw everything clown related at the screen and make it work.
Oh yeah.
Gags about popcorn, cotton candy,
they
balloons.
They've got popcorn guns. They turn people into, you know, store people in cotton candy. They have squirting flowers. They have probably like everybody says, holy shit is kind of the line of the movie. And sure enough, if you ever take a picture with the Kyoto brothers, all at the same, they go, say cheese. And all at the same time, all three brothers go, holy shit. But for my money, the best line in the movie is, what are you going to do with them pies, boys?
Yeah. And apparently acid pies and, what's the other one that, oh, the guard dog that's a balloon dog on a leash.
Oh yes. Like, all of the clown gags are just fun. And this movie is so tongue in cheek that you can't help but love it. In fact, here's the weird thing about it. 'Cause we were questioning whether we were going to talk about it this summer. And you had asked me, like, are we going to do Killer Clowns? And I was like, I don't know. I liked it a lot when I was a kid, but I remember, like, falling out of love with it. And I did, because I got in that snotty period of my life where I didn't really understand the parody of it, where I wasn't really grokking. I thought it was trying to be like really funny, but wasn't as absurd. Was trying to be absurd and funny, but wasn't nearly as funny as something, you know, on the fringe like Freaked or something really truly absurd like the mainstream stuff of Monty Python. It felt very base and crass. And so I sat down to rewatch this for the summer and just was like, holy shit, why did I ever think that? I fucking love this. And then I was invited to go out along with Scott Derrickson, my writing partner, to be on the jury for Cinepocalypse up in Chicago, which is an amazing film festival that you guys should go to. They let me host a 70mm screening of Howard the Duck. And we actually got Howard the Duck trending on Twitter. And most of the top tweets were, why the fuck is Howard the Duck trending?
Which brings to light a serious revelation, which is that there are 70mm prints of Howard the Duck.
70mm
print. There is a single 70mm print of Howard the Duck.
That was made in England and is has the English title of it, which is Howard, a New Breed of Hero.
Interesting, because if there's the only way to watch Howard the Duck is the same way that you would watch Lawrence of Arabia.
Of course.
Clearly.
So, but what they also did was they had a 30th anniversary 35mm screening of Killer Clowns from Outer Space. And I was like, oh, that's great. And when I get there, they the festival people pulled me aside and said, hey, so the Kyoto brothers were wondering if you would like to dress up as one of the Killer Clowns from Outer Space. They have a costume from the movie. Would you like to play that for an opening bit? And I was like, would I? So I was sworn in as an official Killer Clown from Outer Space. Not only am I now an official Lieutenant of Megaforce, I am now also a Killer Clown from Outer Space. So you're going to have to add that to the opening.
Oh, good.
Because what I need is more credit.
Your honorariums aren't long as my fucking dick already. So, yeah, let's just add on another one
now,
while we're at it.
Let's not exaggerate the size of your dick, my friend.
you just have that many honorariums.
So I got to wear the suit of the shadow puppet. Clown, the one that does the shadow play that then eats all the people with the tyrannosaur. And I got to do the shadow play in front of a sold out crowd where they were projecting it. And I did the whole shadow thing. And then, of course, right when the tyrannosaur would go down, a jack in the box comes up, pops up, and then starts screaming at the audience as the Kyoto brothers come out with confetti guns and start spraying confetti into the audience.
I really wish you would stop saying shadow play, because I know how you mean it, because I've seen this movie and I love it, but it sounds like a fetish every time you say it. It's like, I would come out and do shadow play.
Yeah, so I came out and did water sports.
No!
For the audience.
Go back to shadow play. Go back to shadow play.
So I, first of all, that suit, that head is fucking hot as fuck.
I can also only imagine how heavy it must be, because it's an enormous fucking puppet, like,
yeah,
on top of your head.
It is. They do a really great job. Like, that's one of the things about that they do such a great job in the movie. You can't really tell that most of the masks that you're seeing are static. They only have one expression. But because they keep cutting back to a close-up of a mask that they'll have that has the puppetry on it, it'll look like you're looking at the same thing, even though you're looking at something that probably doesn't have anybody in it at all. You're just looking at great puppetry. And it's cut together very well because these guys understand puppetry. But it was really cool to be a fucking killer clown in front of a crowd. And if you want to see what that looks like, check out my Twitter feed. It's in my images, and it's pretty great. Those guys were so much fun. They are exactly who you want them to be. They are three dorks from New York City that are exactly the kind of guys you want to stand around and talk with and have a beer with. And they're all very funny. They're all super friendly. They're all very proud of the movie they made. And it was a great honor to be able to introduce that film and to be inducted into Killer Clowndom.
I feel like that for us is a very Lady of the Lake moment when someone says, would you like to be, when that sword is extended out and you realize the purpose that you're about to undertake.
It's like I said on stage, I was like, you know, all that went through my mind is that line from Ghostbusters. Ray, if someone asks you if you are God, the answer is yes.
You say yes.
Although I had this really fun, awkward moment. Because the thing is I had been there for, you know, the better part of a week, introducing films, hanging out with everybody afterwards, you know, doing jury stuff. We had a book signing, that kind of fun stuff. And so all of the people who were there at the festival pretty much had an idea who I was. Because it was the 30th anniversary screening, they sold out that theater. So they had hundreds of people who were not part of the festival who came in for that single screening. And so after we do the whole thing, I stagger up on stage and Josh, the guy running the festival, says, "Do you guys want to know who's under the mask?" And the crowd's like, "Ah!" And then I take off the mask and he goes, "Holy shit, it's Cargill." Crickets. The writer of Sinister and Doctor Strange. And then they were like, it was that awkward moment of, I'm like, oh God, why have you done this? No one knows who I am.
It's good to know there are still moments that will keep you humble, Cargill. It's good to know that those
moments still
exist.
It's called most of my life, sir.
Okay.
I still pull my pants on two legs at a time. My schvance around my leg three times, just like everybody else does.
Yeah, no, you should definitely
go for
a
swim in my
store.
Cold-plated pool, just as everyone else does. I'm a normal human being.
Absolutely. We didn't mention one of their biggest credits, the Kyoto Brothers. They were the principal puppeteers on Team America World Police.
Yes. They were the ones who were brought in by Matt and Trey because Matt and Trey were big fans of Killer Clowns.
Which makes total sense. Although it also shines a light on how difficult that work is, that people ask Matt and Trey all the time, you know, "Are you ever going to do a sequel to Team America?" And they're like, no, fuck that.
That drove them nuts because the things they were asking the Kyotos to do were kind of nearly physically impossible a lot of the times. The Kyotos had to keep explaining to them, "You can't do that." And they're like, "Well, we have to."
That's a future episode, right? Team America.
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like it has to be, especially
absolutely.
For people like me, and I'm assuming you as well, who grew up watching reruns of Thunderbirds and like the whole Gary Anderson marionation, like that was huge for me as a kid, which actually brings me to how I saw this movie for the first time, because I'm pretty sure it was on the Sci-Fi Channel when I was probably in middle school. And I remember the scene that kind of broke my brain a little bit was, in fact, the shadow play scene where the shadow puppet turns into a Tyrannosaurus and eats all those people. It freaked me out. Like, I'll be the first to admit that even in middle school, when I was watching horror movies, something about that face and like that alien and that laugh and what was happening. And I was just like, no, I'm out. And I didn't watch it again until I moved to Austin, like probably 2009. Was the first time I revisited it, and I just fucking fell in love with all the practical insanity of this film and the whole sci-fi weirdness and how only the 80s could really do something like that. And it just... And
some of the fun writing of it.
There's a lot of fun writing in this. And that's something I actually want to kind of bring us back to, though, is that this movie is a great comedy. It's very silly at points. There are a couple of moments, though, that are straight up... nightmarish.
Yes.
And not just for middle school Brian, but like the scene where John Vernon's character gets turned into a ventriloquist puppet by one of the clowns and says to the guy, "Don't worry, Dave, we just want to kill you." And it's like, what the fuck?
The Kyotos told a story about that they wanted to do like this high-pitched voice. And John Vernon is like, no, trust me on this. Let's just go. And John Vernon did it in his voice and did it that way. And it makes the moment so much creepier because it gives you this sense that they have even more control over you. It's really, really weird and really well done. And John Vernon in that scene, let's just say John Vernon fucking steals every goddamn scene he's into this fucking movie.
He's the only, you know, I mean, no disrespect to this cast, but he's the only name actor in the movie apart from one brief appearance by a very young Chris Titus. I mean, the only real name actor in 1988 in this movie is John Vernon. And you're right. He fucking owns the movie and the room anytime he's on screen. But that's what John Vernon does. I mean, John Vernon is one of the legendary assholes of 80s cinema. Like, anytime you needed a stuffy dean, or in this case, on the fringes, violating all of the amendments police officer, you got John Vernon. And he just made a career out of being the guy that you didn't really want to fuck with in films. And yeah, he is so he's so brutal in every, like, there's scenes where he's just locking people up for drinking in the street. He definitely hates the, it, it's, I think there's a not so subtle reference to Animal House in the fact that he hates everyone from the local college.
Oh yeah.
Every student that like wanders into, there's like this, this conflict between the townsfolk and the kids on the campus, which is, I mean, you find that on in actual college towns, but this felt very much like a reference to Animal House.
Well, I also find it, really, let's go deep into the context here and the time that it came out. We've talked about this. You heard us talk about this, especially during summer of 86 and 87. And see, we're not so much seeing it this year because 86 and 87 was where we were really kind of flipping into the Reaganism. And we were seeing our heroes, you know, as cops who violate rights because who is going to clean up the city? And this is a movie that has the audacity to make the cop a fascist like they were in the 70s and not give over to the cop doing violating the rights being the right thing to do because the villains are so bad. No, the only good guy cop in this is the college kid cop who actually cares about the town and actually is more concerned with keeping the peace than he is, you know, booking people. And there's a moment where, as you said, there's the two kids he throws into the jail that really seem to be gay, and the film seems okay with that. They were two guys going out to drink a bottle of wine together in the park, and they got arrested, and he's throwing them in for drinking and pretty much for being gay.
Wow, that that never dawned on me that that's why he was. It dawned on me at one point that they were gay because of specifically what they said about like drinking the bottle of wine, but it never occurred to me that that's why he was really
pissed at them. That's what this is. This is a very anti-authoritarian commentary in the middle of this fucking farce. And at this time, that was not the message that was playing in mainstream cinema. It was not like, as we talked about last week with A Fish Called Wanda, you know, there was that element of, you know, there's that terrible line in the movie that I had never caught, the buggery line, you know, buggery is worse than killing someone.
Yeah.
This is the opposite of that, where you're feeling empathy for these two guys who did nothing wrong. And in 1989, that's very fucking New York of them, for one thing.
Yeah.
But it's very progressive and very anti-authoritarian in a very interesting way.
Yeah, and if there's one thing the Chiodo brothers are, it's New York as fuck. I listened to the commentary today, and it was like listening to that segment of Animaniacs, The Good Feathers.
Oh, yeah.
It was like listening to that. I mean, these guys are queens as fuck.
Yeah.
They definitely represent Queens very well. By the way, do you want to take a stab at what John Vernon's top four movies on IMDb are? Because I think the answer will surprise you.
Go for it.
Okay, so Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
Animal House.
Yeah.
The Outlaw Josie Wales.
Oh.
And Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Yeah.
Not Point Blank. Not like not any of the other legendary, not Topaz, the fucking Hitchcock movie that he's
in. Dude, I'm telling you, the crowd for we packed in like 650 people for Killer Clowns from Outer Space. It was like a sold out crowd. It was nuts in there. It was just bananas. And that crowd was raucous. And that crowd really, really was into it. It was so much fun to watch with this loud crowd that clearly loved the hell out of this movie. This movie is one of those weird, great cult films that has just stuck with people and I don't think is ever going to age itself out. It's always going to be charming for just the right moment and just the right budget that it was made in.
And I think one of the reasons that that's going to be true is that there is just enough levity, there's just enough silliness that this is a great, to this day, this is a great entry-level horror movie for kids. Because I had this, I was talking about the fact that we were going to be covering this movie with my wife, and she said, oh, I can't wait to show that to Drake, our six-year-old. And my first reaction was, I don't know if, and then I didn't even get the full sentence out before I realized, oh no, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Like, that's a perfect movie because he likes monsters. You know, he's starting to dip his toe into wanting to see scarier stuff, just just so that he could prove he can do it. And I'm like, no, this is actually a really good, it's a good litmus test for.
There's a lot of really good, there's a lot of really great kills in this, but they're not gory. They're right. not, you know, they're not gross. They're not what was happening in the rest of horror in 1988. It was not about, splatterpunk. It's things, people getting hit by ray guns and being turned into cotton candy. It's yeah. people being melted with cream pies. Like I think one of the only gory scenes is not so gory, which is the knocking your block off, which is, ridiculous. In its execution.
Which the Friday the 13th franchise would then totally piggyback on and go, oh, we're going to do that too the very next year, by the way. But you're right. Like, the fact that they replace where there would be blood in another 80s movie with popcorn. Like, it's almost edited itself for television. So I think it's a really good sort of gateway movie for kids who are getting into horror. And I think that's going to be one thing that keeps it fresh and keeps it sort of in the public consciousness and having that cult following and somewhat timeless. It's really interesting that, and I think another thing that makes it perfect for this show is that the Kyoto brothers tell a story on the commentary about how they sold this movie. They sold this movie based on the title. The studio, they went in with a whole pitch ready to go. They had models that they had made and concept art and a whole pitch ready. And when the studio executive heard the title Killer Clowns from Outer Space, they bought it. And the studio executive later said that what he expected to see was just a bunch of guys running around in clown outfits. He had no idea what the movie was going to be.
None.
And bought it anyway. So when you start thinking about a movie like this and we start talking about how it's tongue-in-cheek and about how it's a satire, what you should never take away from that is the idea that the Kyoto brothers were just having a laugh. They put a lot of thought into this movie. More thought, in fact, than the people who greenlit this movie. So I think that's one of the things we always look for when we're talking about cult movies, when we're talking about B-movies that have a higher level of appeal, is we're talking about the artistry of the people who really sunk their heart and soul into it, no matter what it is. And that, to me, is Killer Clowns. Killer Clowns from Outer Space is a definite, you know, labor of love for the Kyoto brothers. I mean, they did so much on this movie. I mean, from, you know, serving as cinematographers, to writing the movie, to directing the movie, to being the mega clown at the end of the film.
Clownzilla is what
Clownzilla. They call it. So, I mean, this is definitely not something that they took lightly. They may have made it a satire. They may have been having fun with it. But this is something that they definitely poured everything they
had
into.
Oh, it was a passion project.
Definitely a passion project. And that's something that we are always going to respect, especially when it turns out to be something as hilarious and awesome as Killer Clowns from Outer Space, which we mentioned that theme song. The other piece of music in this movie that I really love is sort of the, I don't know what to call it other than like the clown mischief theme, which is just, like it just like this whole like rolling synth thing that happens throughout the movie that I think is so great. And there's the first time we hear it is when the clowns are walking out of the spaceship and toward the town, which is this really cool shot where like it's a foggy distance and the first clown walks out. And as he starts walking other clowns, it's almost like a John Carpenter shot. And I was like, wow, that's really cool the way they staggered them like that. Come to find out on the commentary, they had to do that pickup shot so quickly that almost all of the clown actors didn't have time to put their shoes on. So they had to stagger them and then cut before you noticed they weren't wearing shoes. Like, and that to me was so funny. I was like, oh, that's possibly one of my favorite shots of the whole movie. And it was a complete accident.
That's art for you, man. Oddly enough. See, this is one of those, it's odd that you love this score because this is the type of score that you fucking hate.
It is. It's right on the border of score in a box.
It is score in the box. They even acknowledge it's score in the box. That's all they could afford. But the guy who made it was a genius and was so in love with what he wrote, he's actually gone and taken a 76-piece orchestra and rescored the film. So there is a score for Killer Clowns of Outer Space out there with an actual orchestra.
I want to go to there. Because that sounds awesome. And you're right. There actually were a couple points in the movie I was like, oh, this is very score in a box. But most of the time I was so focused on the awesomeness of the creature effects. Like, there is a gag in this movie that is not only a great gag, but a great gif as well. It's when the three clowns show up to deliver the pizza, and then the fourth clown pops up from the pizza box and then fires the ray gun at the girl to turn her into cotton candy. And they laugh. Oh my God, the laughs in this movie.
Yeah.
You want to talk about nightmare fodder. Every time one of these fucking clowns laughs, I'm like, okay, all right. I turn back into that middle school kid where I'm just like, I don't know, guys. I don't know if I can deal with this.
My favorite part of this movie, though, is this scene they have. It's a great, it's a classic writing gimmick. And they're having so much fun with it because it's how do you explain what these things are, why they're this way. And so you have all the characters run through all the theories. And they never confirm a theory, but you can choose which theory you want, which is, you know, maybe they were masquerading themselves as clowns on Earth. Maybe they just stopped by for a bite to eat. Maybe this is where we got the idea of clowns to begin with because they've been here before. And
the pyramid sci-fi theory.
Yeah. And I love how they do that and just the fun of it because it's such a 50s thing to do. And they're playing with such classic sci-fi ideas. And they're just having fun with it. And it just works. The movie is very sharp. It is the only problem this movie suffers from is its budget, which cripples it in certain places, but is what lends it its charm, as I mentioned earlier. The fact that they couldn't build these huge alien spaceship sets, so they had to do it as matte paintings, makes it just look amazing. Like, there's just this wonderful charm to it, and it's just hard to dislike it and give it a hard time because of its budget, because they're getting every dime of that movie on screen.
There, the one moment where they kind of walk into the core of the circus tent slash spaceship is so fucking reminiscent. Again, fetishizing the 50s, I don't think this is accidental either. It is so reminiscent of like the landing dock of the alien ship in This Island Earth.
Yeah.
Where it just looks like a science fiction Flemish painting.
Oh, I guarantee you that's where it came from, because they've made no bones about the fact that they just ripped off a whole bunch of their favorite 50s movies.
Yeah.
By the way, This Island Earth, it should be mentioned, we will probably do an episode on it at some point, because that was a big thing that a friend of mine had up his ass for a long time. Was he really hated the MST3K movie because they did This Island Earth, but they chopped up This Island Earth so that it didn't make a lot of sense and was just a better, quicker thing to do and seemed funnier. I've watched the full movie and I'm like, this is actually a cool fucking movie. This makes a lot more sense than it was made out to be. And so I think, take a drink, Juggies, I think at some point we'll actually sit down and do This Island Earth. But I have no doubts that that the Kyoto's borrowed from This Island Earth.
It would be interesting to do a month of kind of reappropriating movies from Mystery Science Theater, because they also did Danger Diabolik.
Yeah, they did.
Which is like that. What you're talking about with This Island Earth is the feeling I had about Danger Diabolik, which is like, I actually really think this is a cool movie.
Yeah, no, in the 90s, Danger Diabolik was this really cool cult film for a lot of indie film nerds. Like, it was something that I Love Video used as its kind of artwork for a while. Like, that whole kind of Italian sci-fi theme. It was based on a comic book, and it was, mm-hmm. at the time, one of the only good comic book movies. So yeah, we may have to do that. I don't know how much we could repurpose, because they were usually pretty good about choosing terrible movies.
This is true.
I remember seeing a terrible, terrible movie in the movie theater in the 80s and then seeing it on MST3K like 10 years later. And I was like, wait, this is a newer movie. I can't believe they got this. And I'm like, oh yeah, because this is Alien from LA.
Oh, it's Jesus.
Fucking terrible.
Christ.
With Kathy Ireland.
Oh my God.
I saw that on the big screen.
Why did you do that to yourself? Because it was Kathy Ireland.
It was Kathy Ireland, who was at the time one of the most beautiful women in the world. It was Kathy Ireland. I was a very, you know, turning from boy to manhood, you know, just entering teen years.
How's that going for you, by the way?
I'm getting there.
Any day now.
They're going to drop and I'm going to grow hair there and it'll be great.
You're going to have a ball beard to match your actual beard.
I've got a wizard ball beard going on as well. And it was a science fiction film. It was a Hollow Earth movie. And I was like, you don't see Hollow Earth movies. That movie's just terrible. So
I just imagine every so often when we're talking on this podcast that my mother's listening and thinking, I paid to send that motherfucker to college.
And this is what he does.
Could do this with
his
life. He
sits around with a lieutenant from Megaforce and bullshits about killer clowns from outer space.
Well, I mean, that lieutenant of Megaforce is apparently now himself a killer clown from outer space.
Also true.
Man, if we might want to try that some Halloween, like seeing if we could get somebody in town who's really good at fabricating to make a couple of killer clown costumes, like. I would dig the hell out of that.
Yeah, except until you put the head on and then you realize that you're going to suffocate. I was in the head for like, I think 6 or 7 minutes, and I pull the head off and I swear to God, just sweat poured out. And I was like, the Kyoto's going to be smelling me for the next 10 years. And one of the Kyoto's is just like, no, we just douse it down, spritz it with vodka.
That sounds like more of their style. For
and
sure.
Then they were like, one spritz for me, one for the head, one spritz for me, one for the suit, one spritz for me.
I desperately want to hang out with those guys. They sound awesome. Dude,
they're such cool guys. They were so great and enthusiastic. And people asked about a sequel, and oh boy, do they want to do one. And it's like the way they want to do it right now, I see where they want to do it, but I'm suddenly thinking, dude, next time I'm in a room with Jason Blum, I just have to go, Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Make that for $5 million. That could be, that would be
great.
You
could make that for $1 million and it would still be like 10 times the budget they had, so.
Yeah, but it's one of those things that it's like, I'd love to see Blumhouse reboot Killer Clowns from Outer Space. It seems like the kind of thing that Jason might want to do.
With, of course, the one edict that the clowns have to be made practically, because I feel like,
oh, well, that's what they've said. They wanted it, they would do them practically, but technology has gotten so much better.
Oh, okay, so the Kyotos are just going to remake it themselves.
They want to make a sequel.
Okay, got it.
And you could make it. You could do what they're doing with Halloween, which is a sequel that's not titled as a sequel. They're just making a movie putting out called Halloween, but it's, you know, fucking Halloween 9 or whatever.
Right.
You could put out a movie called Killer Clowns from Outer Space and be the Blumhouse reboot, but it's the sequel. It's the clowns coming back, which is what they've talked about. The clowns coming back 30 years later. And you just have a, hey, I heard a story, crazy story about this happening like 32 years ago. Holy shit.
The government would have wiped the town off the map to keep it under wraps. And yeah, no, I think there's definitely ways you could go with that. And of course, it would give an opportunity to answer a lot of unanswered questions about the first movie, not the least of which being Makeout Raft. Can we talk about Makeout Raft for just a second?
Okay, let's talk about Makeout Raft.
So I'm from a different generation than you. I didn't have a designated spot where all the teens went and finger banged or whatever the fuck goes on at a lover's point. But I see it in movies all the time.
So you've never finger banged?
No, I did. I just didn't have a designated spot where all the teenagers met to collectively finger bang.
You do know how finger banging works, right?
Yeah.
There is a designated spot that finger banging is for.
Let's try this again. A designated location where multiple couples of teens were engaged in individual finger banging. Are we clear now? All right, cool. So
you say you're from a different generation. Like my generation had that.
Did you not have that?
No,
I legitimately thought you had that.
No, I mean we had
you are, of course,
old man Cargill. That old man Cargill.
Actually, we did have the cliffs, and the cliffs were you would drive out to the cliffs, and that's where the teens would go to do all manner of debauchery, and you could cliff dive into the water. It wasn't advised, but the water was deep enough that you could cliff dive into it. And there were several caves around, and you would show up, and people would offer you alcohol, people would offer you drugs. You take girls out there to, you know, you sneak off, and I guess you could call that a designated finger banging spot.
Yeah, finger bang central for sure.
A hand job home base.
Now, Cargill, when it comes to hand jobs, the home base is really at the bottom, and then what you want? Why are we doing this?
I have no idea.
I'm sorry, Mom.
Like,
listen.
All of a sudden, we're talking about killer clowns, and we're 13 years old again.
That actually is very apropos.
I mean, I did a dick size joke earlier, for fuck's sake. I mean, what is going on here?
So many beers. Sorrow. What I'm getting at is they pan across Lover's Lane, and one of the characters in this movie is making out with a girl in the back of what looks like a Jeep Wrangler, lying in an inflatable raft.
Sure.
Okay. A raft in the back of a Jeep.
Yes.
As the make out. I don't know.
Do you need a physical explanation for this?
I don't understand.
Okay, first of all,
I've never seen it before. It baffles me a little bit.
It doesn't baffle me because, first of all, Jeep Wranglers back in the 80s were uncomfortable as fuck back there. It was just a metal bed. Like, so you had to put something back there. It was very common in vans to put mattresses in the back of vans in the 70s. Like, that was a thing you did. You put a mattress in a van so that you could get laid in the back of your van.
Sure.
So if you're going to be, like, laying down in the back of something, you're going to want to be comfortable, and an inflatable raft kind of does the trick. I thought it was a cheat. I thought the joke was it was a poor man's version of a mattress in the back of the van, that it was a raft in the back of a Wrangler.
I guess I just don't see how, like, trying to, like, fold up perfectly into an inflatable raft with handles on the side is a comfort decision. It seems, if anything, it would just complicate the issue. The mattress, I totally understand. I've heard songs about Chevy vans, and that's all right with me. I get putting a mattress in the pack. The raft was just an interesting choice.
And you know what the rule is on those? It's okay to have a mattress in a van if it has windows.
If the mattress has windows?
No, if the van has windows, then it's okay to have a mattress in it. If it doesn't, that's creepy.
Oh, that's when it becomes creepy.
Well, yeah.
What's the rule about, like, you can only have an inflatable raft in the back of your 80s Jeep Wrangler if...
You need to be in an 80s movie in which you're killed by clowns?
There it is. Okay, that makes a lot more sense. Apparently, by the way, in that scene, one of the Kyoto brothers, the photography's a little too dark, but is in the background, like, peeing behind one of the cars. Like, he's in the movie as a character, and the scene was too dark, so you can't even see him doing it. I thought that was pretty funny. But yeah, I guess, yeah, sorry about the sidebar, but the inflatable raft and the makeout mobile was just... very baffling to me. But let's talk about some of our... I mean, we've talked about a few of the kills in this movie. One other extremely creepy moment is when one of the clowns is trying to tempt a little girl out of the Big Top Burger, the local fast food joint, which I think might also be the name of the fast food joint in Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, but I'm not entirely sure on that. I know there was definitely a circus motif to that burger stand as well. But he's trying to tempt this little girl out, and he's this particular clown. Like, these clowns all have really ghastly faces. Like, they're wearing clown makeup, but there's just something very, like, easily identifiable as creepy about their faces. Like, you would not ever go near it. But all of a sudden, this particular clown looks very jovial, looks very sweet as he's, like, sitting out there and waving to her, playing peekaboo. And then as he's trying to tempt her out, like, Wile E. Coyote's got a giant fucking mallet. But it just, I remember thinking that that's one of the two scenes in this movie that I'm like, this is legitimately unnerving. Like, this is when you're reminded, like, yeah, this is funny, but don't forget it's a fucking horror movie, because it's a fucking horror movie. Like, that will sit with me for a long time.
Yeah.
And that and the John Vernon ventriloquist dummy. Like,
yeah, that's the one that I find is, like, truly disturbing. Like, it's silly, but it's not as funny as some of the other deaths. It's not as absurd as the other deaths. It's genuinely creepy how it's done.
Yeah.
That's the one that sticks with me as, like, the really, like, ew.
But that is, of course, where Dave, we haven't even talked about the fact that there's a love triangle going on with our three lead characters in this movie, where we have our lead character, Mike Tobacco. It's going to make me laugh every time I fucking say it. Yes. And his girlfriend, Debbie. And then there's Dave Hansen, who's the young cop that we mentioned before, who's kind of butting heads with John Vernon throughout the movie. Apparently, Dave and Debbie used to date. And so as the three of them are battling the threat of the killer clowns, there's also this sort of odd kind of love tension between them. But this is where Dave discovers the one weakness of the clowns from outer space. The weakness being,
if you shoot them in the nose,
they will explode. And it's kind of... I'm going to go back to Mystery Science Theater. I'm really glad we brought this up. Because he discovers that, and then it takes him It takes the three of them roughly another 30 minutes to really put that to use. And it reminded me a lot of, there's a movie they covered in Mystery Science Theater called The Horror of Party Beach, which is about these fish monsters that look like they have hot dogs in their mouths. It's fucking, it's like Beach Blanket Bingo meets The Creature from the Black Lagoon, which are two bad tastes that don't go well together. But early on in that movie, scientists discover that sodium kills these monsters and do nothing with that information until the very end of the film. So much that the running joke for the bots is like, so sodium? Anyone? Sodium? Just anybody at all? Sodium. And then it's just funny because when they discover the shooting them in the nose destroys them, it's a while before they start to really take advantage of that information. And again, I'm just like, oh, this is yet another of the 50 sci-fi tropes that they're kind of playing with. They are really reaching deep into the canon of what made a 50 sci-fi movies, from the, you know, the dissenting older authority figures to, you know, yeah, just everything about a 50s sci-fi movie is alive and well.
This was something that happened in The Blob as well,
yeah.
In the 88, where we find very early what its weakness is, but we don't use that weakness until the very end of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, we don't exploit it, because then once we exploit it, then it's just an action movie. Then it's just aliens, and we're just running around killing lots of them. And that's not scary. So you've got to kind of hold and keep the tension up until you get to that moment where you're going to start knocking them off.
I would agree with that entirely. And before we wrap up there, I think we really need to talk about one of the unsung heroes of this movie, which is actually Charles Kyoto, who did all the production design on this movie, because anytime they are in that ship, holy fuck. Like, the amount of space he explores, despite having no budget, and the sets that he puts together, like, it is no surprise to me that these guys at one point worked with Sid and Marty Croft, because this looks like deranged H.R. Puffin stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The sets.
Absolutely.
And it's fucking phenomenal. Like, I get lost just like, I'm so glad I have this on Blu-ray, because in high def, it really sticks out how much range they got out of one or two sound stages. Like, they really, when they start running through mazes and there are multiple sort of creature heads and towers of blocks and, like, multiple doors that are actually functioning doors. Like, you open one door, there's another one. It's such a great clown sight gag that is actually a functional entryway as well. Like, he really put in the time to make this something remarkable and memorable. Like, there is no other movie that looks like Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Like, it is wholly its own creature.
Yeah. No, it's a huge, huge creative palette all its own, with a look and feel that's unlike anything else of the era.
Yeah.
Like, it is a movie out of time. The movie it most reminds me of is a movie, Take a Drink, Junkies. We will talk about it. We've mentioned a couple times we're going to talk about it. Freaked, by Alex Winter, which would be made 5 years later, with Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves and Mr. T and Brooke Shields, and is just a zany, crazy farce that doesn't fit in with anything else of the time. Like, this does not, like, as much as we talk about how it would make a great apocalypse trilogy with those other two movies, it still has a tone and a look and a feel all its own. Like, you wouldn't put this film with those films for that. You would only put it for the thematic content, because there's really nothing else that hits this. There's other things that try to do this in the era. Another one is Return of the Killer Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. But Return of the Killer Tomatoes has a lot of fun with the fact that they have no budget and has a similar tone, but doesn't have any scenes where you're like, well, yeah, despite it being funny and having George Clooney, this looks amazing, or this whole sequence is great. It's like, no, there's none of that in Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
Did you happen to catch the element of Killer Clowns that would make it a great double feature with Return of the Killer Tomatoes? Christopher Titus is drinking beer brand beer.
Oh, yeah, he's drinking beer brand beer.
And it's literally just the white can with black letters that say beer.
Yeah, generic beer.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it's a good moment. And yeah, these would be two fun movies together. But, like, the reason why I think this goes with Freaked is Freaked was the production designer was, I think, Catherine Hardwicke. I think that's who it was.
Really?
Who went on to become a director, yeah. And her her production design is brilliant and original and psychedelic and fucked up in all the same ways that this movie is, but each having its own distinct look. This is clearly Kyoto, and it's so well done. And all the clowns look amazing.
They do, and they're so different from one another.
Yeah, there's no uniform for every clown is radically different, and each one is amazing and creepy and well designed and just looks great. Also, by the way, something I learned from the Kyotos: when you walk like a killer clown, you're supposed to walk like you're underwater, like, because these killer clowns walk, that was their direction. You walk like you're underwater.
I like that.
And you're walking very slow and creepy and plotty because they're not fast.
Also, something that I learned from the Kyotos on the commentary that would make this an even better double feature with Night of the Creeps is that the explanation they gave for these being aliens that look like clowns is that they're actually slugs, and that's not paint on their face. That's just the way their faces look. So they are interstellar slugs whose facial markings happen to resemble clown paint. And I'm like, oh, interstellar slugs. I think I can think of a movie where they're...
I think I've seen that movie.
Hey, I understood that reference. But yeah, everything about this movie, top to bottom, is just so, as silly as it is so deliberately plotted out and so deliberately constructed. And I'm not just talking about the sets, and I'm not just talking about the makeup. Every joke in this movie, every reference in the movie. I mean, the two guys in this movie who play the ice cream truck drivers, who seem like a bad stand-up comedy act. Apparently, there's something to the idea that they are the analog of the Kyoto brothers. They mentioned that a couple times in the commentary. Like, these guys are basically just us, kind of filtered through the world of killer clowns from outer space.
They're two losers who bought an ice cream truck because they thought it would get them laid.
The Terenzi brothers, yes. Yeah, they tell a story on the commentary about how these two guys apparently were cast because they came in together and started doing bits. And one of the bits is that they started doing regular comedy and then started stripping off their clothes. And they were wearing ballerina outfits underneath and just never addressed it. Just kept doing comedy. And that apparently tickled the Kyoto brothers. And that's why they're in this movie. So there you have it, folks. Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Watch it alone. Watch it with Night of the Creeps. Watch it with The Blob. I think there's not a
show it to your son.
Show it. Yeah. I mean, I'm serious. I really think this is going to be a great gateway, not only to introducing my kids to 80s movies, but to horror in general. So that's something that I'm always going to appreciate. And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which for the second week in a row could not be easier. I think it's got to be cotton candy. I don't know of any other snack that would
be. Oh, no,
better.
I do.
Really?
I do.
Then cotton candy in Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Well, I mean, really, Killer Clowns from Outer Space is its own thing. There's nothing like it.
Uh-huh.
It's an acquired taste. I would say Circus Peanuts.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Talk about an acquired taste that I have not acquired.
Yeah, no. A lot of people really hate Circus Peanuts, but if you like Circus Peanuts, they're a thing all their own.
Let me tell...
Although, if you're going to go another, I might suggest Kettle Corn also would be a really good... For those that like Kettle Corn.
Again, an acquired taste that I have not acquired. But let me tell a quick story that I learned in the commentary that I think really settles the case for cotton candy. There's that scene where Dave and Mike Tobacco... Go back to Finger Bang City, and they...
Finger Bang City!
Sunday,
this week
Sunday,
we got
Sunday.
One finger, two finger, three fingers.
All the fingers the pig, you can
one in the stink.
And it's just south of Fistburg. So,
the Fistburg in Pittsburgh.
What the fuck were we talking about? So they go back to Finger Bang City. And they're looking at all the cars.
Take me down to Finger Bang City where the grass is green. The girls are pretty.
And there's grass on the field and the girls are pretty. Oh, won't you please stop this joke?
All right.
No, I'm talking to both of us.
Yeah, he took us to Finger Bang City.
And man. I will forever...
You just were having fun with the phrase Finger Bang City.
And now it's been said about a billion times. So inside all
we're
the cars...
We're going to have to explain what finger banging is to Meryl.
I'm so sorry, not only to Meryl, but to a lot of people listening. So, you know what? Don't make this a gateway podcast for your kids, because that's probably a bad idea.
That's a really bad idea.
Don't do it. Inside the cars at Finger Bang City are no longer people doing it on makeout rafts, but instead their cars are filled with cotton candy, insinuating that the clowns have been there and taken out all of the teens. And the kiddos tell a great story about how one of those cars was a promo vehicle, a Jeep promo vehicle that basically was given to them to use and for no cost as long as the car got advertised. And it was a great deal for them because they didn't have a lot of budget. And they were assured by the special effects department that there was a solvent that they could basically put inside the car that would make sure that this fake cotton candy that was applied with a fucking cement truck mixer would be able to just, you'd come right out. There won't be a mark left on the car. Fortunately, it wasn't true, and the car suffered about $3,000 worth of damage. Now, it was only $3,000 because what they did in true Kyoto Brothers style is they took that car to a different dealership, didn't tell that dealership what the situation was, just that they needed it fixed, paid the $3,000 to get that car fixed, and took it back to the original dealership and didn't tell them what had happened. So that is some fucking Roger Corman shit if ever
that's,
I heard it.
That's Corman as fuck.
It's Corman as fuck, which, by the fucking way, guys, if you haven't listened to it, this week's episode of
It's the Movie Cramps
is an interview with the legendary Roger Corman.
I had to keep quiet about that for several weeks.
Dude, it made
Lynch
my heart.
Messaged me about that, and I was like...
Made my heart so happy. I got to interview Roger Corman in 2009, and if I had had a whole hour with him, I would have like lost my shit. I had packed so many questions into a small amount of time because it really was like, you want to talk about a Lady of the Lake moment, like Excalibur being extended. Would you like to interview Roger Corman? Oh, fucking yes, I would like to interview Roger Corman.
Well, I mean, come on. When one of our earliest episodes, like fucking 4 or 5 years ago, we have no idea at this point, was us interviewing Dick Miller.
Yeah.
And what did we talk about the whole fucking time? We wanted to talk about fucking Roger Corman.
Yeah.
And he lit up.
Yeah.
Like he was doing interviews and, you know, he's an older guy. But everyone was asking him about Gremlins and everyone was asking him about like the 80s stuff. And we wanted to talk about Rock All Night and Piranha
and Bucket of Blood.
And he was over the moon to tell old Corman stories. And Corman is on that list of people we would love to talk to. But you know what? The Movie Crypt beat us to it. So check that out. It's a great fucking interview.
It really is a spectacular interview. I very much enjoyed listening to that. And I hope you have very much enjoyed listening to this episode of Junk Food Cinema about killer clowns from outer space. Oh my God. I'm going to go home and watch it again. I'm going to go home right now and watch this movie again. I'm so excited about it. If you are so excited about this podcast, you can find our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio. If you do go to iTunes, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show,
I mean really like the
show. If you like it more than trips to Finger Bang City, you can
go... Finger Bang City!
Finger Bang City!
Then what?
I'm sorry. I'm sitting in the shame of myself right now and just letting that really take over. You can go to patreon.com. Please, if you are a patron, please don't take your money away because of this episode. I would greatly appreciate that. Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. For as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to content no one else gets to hear, and only about 20% of it is about finger banging. I can assure you of that.
I have a feeling that Finger Bang City is not going to go away. I think that's going to be like a Jürgen pause now.
Or right? The Nitro back in the box.
Yeah, I have a feeling... Finger Bang City.
Well, you know, I am still finding...
Come back in the future.
I am still finalizing our store online and what phrases to put on t-shirts, so congratulations, Finger Bang City. You might have just graduated to t-shirt town. Oh, boy. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Fingerbangcity.org.
.org.
.com.
.com.
It's a 501c, fingerbangcity.org.
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massawyrm. That's M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M. You can find my new book, We Are Where the Nightmares Go, in bookstores now, or wherever you buy books or listen to books. Also, my Arthur C. Clarke shortlisted science fiction novel, Sea of Rust, is still available everywhere. So seek that out. And that's where you can find my stuff.
So fingerbangcity.org, the cause that it's supporting is the in Fingerbang City, they have really terrible plumbing. So it's going to check all of the pipes to make sure that they are functioning properly in Fingerbang City. You know, guys, I just want to remind you that this is a classy fucking show.
We're so classy.
So classy, you don't even know it. But if you weren't afraid of clowns before...
I love how ashamed you are of this episode right now. You're just like...
I'm ashamed of me, mostly.
Why have I done this? What have I done?
What have I done? Anyway, if you weren't already afraid of clowns or finger banging... I'm just going to push the button, Frank.
Push the button, Frank.
Okay, so Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Hi, guys. It's Christopher Titus. It was my first movie, first thing I ever did. I had gone on some auditions. I had auditioned for the Huey Lewis Power of Love video with an English accent, and they busted me on it in the casting room. I was a little nuttier there, so I went into this audition, and I was just goofy as Bob McReed. He didn't give a shit, and he was throwing stuff and doing what he was doing. Knew I didn't get the audition, and about 2 weeks after that, I got a call that said, hey, you got to do this movie. I'd read the script. I thought it was the silliest, funniest script I'd read in a long time. Of course, I'd only read two scripts at that time in my life. And so what I did was I went down to Santa Cruz, which I knew it. It was done in Northern California. It was great. And I'm like, okay, going to ease me in. They're going to give me an easy scene. And the weirdest thing I got about show business was I was sitting around before you guys came to get me to shoot, before they came to get me, and talking to a bunch of these actors, and they're like, yeah, I was on this, and I was on that, and I did the show with Don Johnson. I did this thing with Tom Selleck, and they're talking big names. I did the De Niro thing. You did the De Niro thing? How'd that go? And I go, wow. I go, what part are you playing in this movie? Oh, I'm an extra. I was sitting amongst the extras. Now, that's not a bad thing, but it was interesting to hear how people talked about being on a set and walking through the scene. I had role a part. I didn't say anything at that point. I was like, oh, I'm speaking. I should have. So the first scene, they're going to ease me in, right? I'm going to do something. I'm going to walk in. I'm going to do whatever. First thing they guys give me is where it's the middle of the night. The ice cream truck pulls in. I pull in a Jeep. This is what I'm supposed to do. Pull in a Jeep. Pull to the edge of a cliff with a fence. Stand up on the edge of the Jeep. Throw beers to three friends. Then get back into the Jeep and start kissing my girlfriend. And I've never acted before. You need to know, people, I have never acted. I didn't have an acting class at this time. I had one half a semester at College of Marin. That's all I had. So I come in and some comedy. So I come in and I drive the Jeep into the scene and I pull up to the fence and I get out and I do my thing, throw the beers, and I get back. And as I'm on the edge of the Jeep rolls into this fence that's on the cliff. Now, I didn't know the fence was balsa wood. It was a prop fence. I thought it was a real fence. So this Jeep just goes, and it's now, front end of it's now hanging over this cliff. The wheel's barely on the edge. And I hear the director, one of the Keanu brothers, goes, cut! And these grips just run over. They rip me out of the car. They grab the girl, pull her out. Someone pulls the e-brake, and everybody's standing around going, and I felt like the biggest dick for the rest of the entire shoot. Got to work with a really cool character actor there. What's his name? I want to say Vince, but it's not. He played the cop in it. He was great. He called me a son of a bitch in the first thing. It was a fun thing. And one of my lamest lines is, "Wow, check this out! I actually talked like people I made fun of in comedy at that time." So that was my experience on Killer Clowns from Outer Space. And working with the Keanu brothers was amazing. I wish I wasn't so far in my own head at the time because I probably would have enjoyed it a lot more. Killer movie. And I hate signing the DVDs. I really do. On all the DVDs, I write, fuck you, Titus. anyways, talk to you guys later. Thanks.